This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Para Tolson. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin.
And I'm going to write a letter to King George III. Oh, the nerve of him, saying that nothing of importance happened today.
He wrote that on July 4th, and certainly something of importance did happen that day. Historically, the United States came into being, but he didn't hear about it until August the 8th.
Then he went and said the same thing about August 10th, my birthday. Wait until he hears about that.
Bob, I don't think he's interested in your birthday.
And that's why I'm writing him a card for his birthday on June 4th, 1738. But it won't be 35 days until he hears about it. It'll be 28 years.
Why so long?
Because it was 28 years after he was born that he bought Buckingham Palace. I've got something to say about the way he treats the place.
Bob, he hasn't been in Buckingham Palace for quite a while.
And look what's happening to the place.
What's happening to the palace?
Have you seen the grounds around the place?
Yes, we have, and they are beautiful.
They certainly are. Gorgeous flowers, meticulously cared for, and wonderful attraction.
Then, why do they keep ripping them out? One month I looked up, they ripped out all the gardens every other day.
They don't tear up the gardens at Buckingham Palace every other day.
Oh, yes, they do. And people crowd around just to watch. They sometimes come 1 to 2 hours early just to get a good place to stand. They crowd around and they take pictures, and then they go home and brag about what they watched.
I've never heard of this.
See? That's what happens when King George writes things like nothing of importance happened today. And meanwhile, they're tearing out the gardens every other day.
Where did you hear this?
Just go check the internet. You'll see the crowds. They even post the times for the event. The changing of the garden.
Oh, my God. That's not the changing of the garden. It's the changing of the guard.
What?
The changing of the guard. A new group of sentries arrives in colorful costume.
Those colors aren't the gardenias?
No, just guards. It's the changing of the guard.
Never mind.
Let's go on to where something of importance really did happen, on August 14th.
On August 14th of 2003, at 4 o'clock p.m., a power outage occurred in the eastern United States and Canada. The outage affected over 50 million people, and in some places the power remained off for more than a day. It affected hospitals and airports and even amusement parks, where some people were caught in mid-ride.
Immediately, the blame game started. Politicians especially were criticizing anyone they thought wasn't doing their job. When the smoke settled, it was discovered that the problem originated at the First Energy Company in Ohio. Overgrown trees came into contact with power lines and the shutdown cascaded.
Did you know that during the blackout in New York City, there were few reports of looting and other blackout-related crime? The police reported there were 100 fewer arrests than usual.
On August 14th of 1935, Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Federal Social Security Act. Roosevelt had come into office in the midst of the Great Depression, and this act was part of the so-called New Deal, which developed programs like Works Progress Administration and the Civilian Conservation Corps that put Americans back to work.
In a public statement on this date, FDR expressed concern for the young people who were thinking of what would become of them when they reached old age. He acknowledged that you wouldn't make guarantees about everything, but the act would prevent senior citizens from ending up in poverty.
Although established to combat unemployment, the Social Security system now acts as a safety net for elderly and disabled.
On August 14, 1784, Gregory Shelikov, a Russian explorer, established the first permanent Russian settlement at Three Saints Bay in Alaska. Europeans had discovered Alaska earlier.
Vitus Bering, for whom the Bering Strait is named, made two trips into the area, the first in 1725 and then again in 1741. On his second voyage, he took ill and died. He was buried on the island that was to bear his name, Bering Island.
In 1790, Shelikov returned to Russia and with an associate, Ivan Golikov, began the company that was to become the Russian-American Company.
In 1799, Alexander Baranov was appointed chief manager, and under him, fur trading outposts were extended down the Pacific coast all the way to Bodega Bay. Baranov advocated educational opportunities for Alaskan Native Americans, and under his leadership, schools were created. Frontier communities became less isolated, and Orthodox missionaries were brought in.
After the Crimean War, interest in the area declined as a cash-strapped Russia sought to find buyers for the Alaska Territory. President Buchanan was approached, but negotiations stalled because of the Civil War. After the war, Secretary of State Seward concluded the negotiations at the price of $7.2 million, about 2 cents an acre. The Senate easily ratified the purchase in 1867, but it would be another year before the House agreed to pay the money.
The plan was ridiculed by many critics. It was called Seward's Folly, or Seward's Icebox, or Andrew Johnson's Polar Bear Garden. Then came the gold rush in the Klondike. Guess who had the last laugh?
On August 14, 1776, the city of Boston observed the 11th anniversary of the popular resistance to the Stamp Act. This act passed Parliament on March 22, 1765, and it required the colonists to place a British stamp on every document they obtained.
Reaction was furious. The colonies convened the Stamp Act Congress to voice opposition. The famous cry arose, "No taxation without representation." When the stamps were delivered to the colonies, merchants called for a boycott on all English goods.
There were organized attacks on custom houses and even on the homes of the tax collectors. In every state but Georgia, the stamp master resigned, making it impossible to collect the taxes.
On March 18, 1766, Parliament repealed the Stamp Act, but at the same time passed the Declaratory Act. This act asserted that the British government had free and total legislative power over the colonies. However, it carefully omitted any mention of the right of Parliament to tax the colonies.
Although the rallying cry had been, "No taxation without representation," which led to the repeal of the Stamp Act, the same day that Parliament passed the Declaratory Act, they also passed the Revenue Act of 1766. This action was intended to make up for the lost revenue from the Stamp Act. This act imposed a tax on molasses, which the colonists paid without complaint.
Did you know that molasses was the main ingredient in the making of rum? One must be sensible about which taxes to oppose.
On August 14th of 1751, Francis Blandy fell into a coma and died in his home outside of London. His daughter, Mary, then offered the servants a large amount of money to help her get to France immediately. They refused.
Then the neighbors found out that Mr. Blandy had been poisoned, so they chased Mary down and caught her. Seems that Mary, 26 and unmarried, had been having an affair with one William Cranston, who was penniless.
He also had a wife back in Scotland and wanted to get hold of some of the Blandy family fortune.
Not knowing of Cranston's matrimonial commitments, Mr. Blandy had at first approved of their marriage. And then Cranston, wanting to do the right thing, wrote to his wife back in Scotland, asking her to disavow the marriage. Needless to say, Mrs. Cranston was not amused.
Neither was Mr. Blandy, and he ordered Cranston out.
Frustrated with the lack of success to get hold of the Benjamins, or the pounds sterling in this case, and Mary, still 26 and unmarried, decided to hold on to her loan prospect, so the couple went to Plan B.
Which was to slip arsenic into Daddy's food over time and slowly kill him.
Problem. The servants had suspected something amiss, and so had saved some of the powder that they had seen her slip into Daddy's food and handed it over to the police. That was enough to convict her, and she was sentenced to be hung.
If you're wondering about poor Mr. Cranston, he remained that way. He escaped to France and later died there in poverty.
There is a moral to this story, kind of. about to be hung, Mary told the executioner, "Not too high, for decency's sake."
Did you know who once owned the rights to most of the Beatles' songs? How about Guess Two? Here's the story. Performers often enter into arrangements with companies to handle their royalties. The Beatles had such an arrangement with Northern Songs, a company partly owned by John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
In 1969, there was a contentious takeover at Northern Songs, which led John and Paul to pull out of the association. 15 years later, as the company prepared to sell all of its publicity rights, Paul was working to make the purchase. He was outbid.
Did you know that the person who outbid Paul on August 14, 1985, was Michael Jackson? And did you know that in 2008, he ceded all of his rights to Sony Corporation, one of Jackson's principal creditors?
On August 14, 1980, a major labor strike began at the shipyards in Gdansk, Poland. It was led by Lech Walesa and brought him into world prominence as the head of the Solidarity labor movement.
On August 14th of 1862, the invasion of Kentucky by Confederate forces began. General Kirby led the invading troops as a part of a plan to draw federal troops away from Chattanooga and raise support for the Southern cause in Kentucky.
And on August 14th, 1971, St. Louis Cardinal pitcher Bob Gibson threw the first no-hitter of his major league career. The Cardinals won the game against the Pittsburgh Pirates 11-0. Gibson pitched 17 years for the Cardinals, winning 251 games. And in the World Series against Detroit in 1968, he struck out 17 batters.
And now a look at August 15th. In 1969, Woodstock opened on a patch of farmland at White Lake, a hamlet in Bethel, New York. Originally, the plan for the music festival was a way of raising funds to build a recording studio and rock and roll retreat near the town of Woodstock.
Plans almost fell through when the town of Wallkill denied permission to hold the event. The festival was saved when a local farmer, Max Yasker, agreed to let them use 600 acres of his farm.
Early estimates of 50,000 to 200,000 attendees were dwarfed when 400,000 people showed up clamoring to get in. There were so many people that the promoters lost all hope of charging for an entrance and just turned it into a free concert.
They heard performers like Richie Havens, who opened the event.
The Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane.
The Who. Creedence Clearwater.
Santana. Joe Cocker.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Joan Baez and Arlo Guthrie.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Sha-na-na.
And Climax by Jimi Hendrix.
Did you know there were surprisingly few incidents of violence during the three-day event? A fitting example at a time of anti-war protests.
Right. On this day in 1964, Soviet Premier Khrushchev stated that he was ready to begin arms talks. This statement was interpreted as an indication that he sought to limit the possibility of nuclear conflict. His comments were made at a news conference less than 2 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
In 1963, the U.S. and the Soviet Union had signed a limited arms treaty banning the testing of nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, underwater, and in outer space. Khrushchev's comments on the 15th of August went further than that and suggested a conference the following year.
Nothing came of the suggestion. First, because there was a U.S. election coming up and President Johnson didn't want to commit. Secondly, hardliners in Russia didn't approve of Khrushchev's willingness to cooperate. In October of 1964, Khrushchev resigned as prime minister.
On August 15, 1914, the Panama Canal officially opened to traffic. This cut the journey from West America to East America by 8,000 miles. The first ship officially through was the SS Ancon, a passenger and cargo ship. I say officially because 2 days earlier, the SS Cristobal had passed through the canal. But since the canal was not yet officially open, the Ancon gets the credit.
The area of the Panama had originally been a part of Colombia, and after a railroad had been built across the isthmus, talks began about the possibility of building a canal. Colombia awarded a contract to the French company that had built the Suez Canal, and so the original plans also called for this to be a sea-level-to-sea-level canal.
Work began in 1881, and soon the French discovered that sea-level-to-sea-level wasn't that easy to accomplish. Because of inadequate planning, disease, and financial difficulties, the French firm went bankrupt.
Now, America had acquired an overseas empire following the Spanish-American War, and so looked at American ownership of the canal as imperative. The chance came in 1903 when the northern area seceded from Colombia and set up the Republic of Panama. The United States quickly recognized the new republic, and a treaty was soon completed which allowed for America to build the canal.
The American version was not sea level to sea level. Passage depends upon a series of locks through the mountainous regions that acts like a series of elevators that raises and lowers the vessels along the route. The advantage of this can be seen when you realize that the variance of tides on the Pacific side of the canal is 20 feet, while on the Atlantic side, it's only 3 feet.
Work on the canal began in 1909 and was completed August 14, 1914. It officially opened for business the next day. According to provisions of a treaty, the ownership of the canal reverted to the Republic of Panama on December 31, 1999. Did you know that following this transfer of ownership, Panama signed a 25-year contract for the operation of the canal with a firm from Hong Kong?
Did you know that the direction of passage through the canal is actually more north-south than it is east-west?
Did you know that it takes 52 million gallons of water to pass through the canal's lock system? And if the lake and dam that controls the water supply were to be destroyed, it would take 5 to 7 years to refill the lake before passage could begin again.
A man, a plan, a canal, Panama. It's a palindrome. Pretty neat, huh?
Okay. Then how about this? A man, a plan, a cat, a ham, a yak, a yam, a hat, a canal, Panama.
Now I've got one. A man, a plan, a canoe, pasta, heroes, rajas, a coloratura, maps, snipe, percale, macaroni, a gag, a banana bag, a tan, a tag, a banana bag again, or a camel, a crepe, pins, spam, a rut, a rolo, cash, a jar, sore hats, a peon, a canal, Panama.
Can we fit in lions and tigers and bears?
Oh, my.
Not if it takes another 52 million gallons of water.
On August 15th of 1947, India and Pakistan won their independence. The Indian Independence Bill was a long-awaited settlement that ended 200 years of British rule. A large part of the impetus for this settlement came from the actions of Mohandas Gandhi. Gandhi called the bill the noblest act of the British nation.
The issue of Indian self-government has been going on for some time, and following the end of World War II, there had been British promises, but Indian leaders didn't want to depend on just promises. So they began the Quit India campaign to hasten their leaving.
One difficulty was the religious strife in the area between Muslims and Hindus. In 1947, the India League grudgingly accepted the creation of Pakistan as a Muslim state to appease one faction. It didn't work.
On August 15th, the Independence Bill took effect, and soon thereafter followed a period of religious turmoil that would result in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in India and Pakistan.
Did you know that one of those people was Gandhi? He was assassinated in 1948 by a Hindu fanatic during a prayer vigil.
Methinks there may be method in the madness of what follows. According to some historians, there really was such a person as Macbeth. He was the grandson of King Kenneth II. He also had a claim to the throne through his wife, Gruach, who was granddaughter of King Kenneth III.
Kenneth III was a Scottish king who had been overthrown by Malcolm II, who was the predecessor of Duncan, Macbeth's cousin.
Under Duncan, Macbeth was the governor of the province of Moray. He was a trusted military commander. trusted, that is, until he disagrees with Duncan's ties to the Saxons and he rises in rebellion.
He kills Duncan, not in bed, but in a battle near Elgin on August 14, 1040. He is crowned King of Scotland later this same month.
After 14 years of rule, Macbeth suffers a defeat at the Battle of Dunsinane against Seward, the Earl of Northumbria.
Seward is acting on behalf of Malcolm Canmore, who is Duncan's son.
Hostilities between the two camps continued over the next 3 years and finally came to a head at the Battle of Lumphanan on August 15, 1057, when Macbeth was killed by Malcolm.
Did you know that when King Duncan was killed by Macbeth, Duncan was not considered a popular king, especially since Duncan had been leaning towards the Saxons and Macbeth was strongly Celtic? Many considered Duncan a tyrant.
Did you know that the successor to the throne after Macbeth's death was his son, Lulach? So Lady Macbeth was not childless.
And did you know that a record of all these events from 1040 to 1057 were placed in a time capsule which found its way to Stratford-upon-Avon sometime between 1603 and 1606. It's not known whether anyone ever did anything with it, or if they did, nobody ever says you know whose name while they're doing it.
Maybe you can't say that name, but you can say the name Tempest. On August 15, 1635, the first recorded U.S. hurricane hit the Plymouth colony with the winds up to 130 miles an hour.
Now, don't worry. When William Bradford, the head of the Plymouth colony, wrote about it, he kept it in a teapot.
All's well that ends well, I suppose. And on to August 16th. In 1896, gold is discovered in the Yukon. George Cormack had come from California to Alaska in 1881 looking for gold. For almost 15 years, his luck was bad. Then he headed north into the Yukon Territory, where he heard from another prospector that gold had been sighted on the Klondike River. So that's where he went.
On August 16th, Cormack and two Native American companions discovered a gold nugget sticking out of a rock not far from the river. They staked their claim. News travels fast, and within the next 2 years, 50,000 gold seekers had invaded the Yukon Territory. When Cormack left, he took about 1 million of gold with him. The gold rush in the Yukon didn't end until 1966, and by then, the area had yielded about 250 million in gold.
Most of the later comers were not so lucky. Did you know that one of those latecomers was Jack London, who used his experiences in the area to write several books?
We're probably familiar with White Fang and The Call of the Wild, but how about The Iron Heel, People of the Abyss, and War of the Classes? The experience in the Yukon also helped make him an advocate of unionization, socialism, and the rights of workers.
Did you know that Erastus Baynard, a Seattle newspaperman, began a worldwide campaign to establish his city as the preeminent supplier of goods and the major debarkation point for the gold fields? Jack London never wrote a story about him.
Paul Robeson was one of the best-known African-American entertainers in the world. If you don't know the name immediately, remember the man in Showboat singing Old Man River. That's Paul Robeson. Robeson was also one of the most well-known critics on racism.
Robeson had traveled all over the world to appear, and while performing, he often made comments about his feelings on racism. One such remark was that the Soviet Union had disavowed racism, while America had not. During World War II, while Russia was allied with America, his comments were tolerated. When the Cold War heated up, they were not.
Sounds like a problem between the message and the messenger coming up.
No problem. When Robeson applied to have his passport renewed in 1950, the State Department said no unless he signed a loyalty oath. Robeson refused, saying, "Of course I won't sign it. I consider this an invasion of every constitutional liberty that I have." So Robeson went to court, and on August 16, 1955, the court held that the State Department did have the right to deny the application for renewal.
Robeson continued his legal fight, and in 1958, his appeal was heard by the Second Court, and this time it ruled in his favor. Grudgingly, the State Department did renew his passport, but the damage to his career was effective. The FBI continued to investigate him until his death in 1976.
Did you know that Paul Robeson also attended Rutgers University and graduated in 1919 as valedictorian? He also had lettered 15 times in basketball, football, baseball, and track, and was twice named to the All-America football team. And he went on to graduate from the Columbia School of Law in 1923. He supported himself by playing professional football on weekends.
Because of the racism he encountered in the workplace, he found it impossible to practice law effectively, and so developed a career in singing and the theater. Among other roles, he played Othello in three separate productions and set a record on Broadway when he played opposite the famed Uta Hagen for 296 performances.
He was honored in 2004 by the U.S. Postal Department when a 37-cent commemorative stamp was issued with his picture on it. It was a part of the Black Heritage series, which included Harriet Tubman, W.E.B. Du Bois, Thurgood Marshall, and Martin Luther King, Jr.
At last, the messenger received some degree of recognition.
On August 16, 1841, President John Tyler was hung in effigy during a demonstration at the White House. The issue? The National Bank.
The Federal U.S. Bank had been created by Alexander Hamilton and put into place by George Washington in 1791. But the idea of a national bank was not nationally agreed upon.
Thomas Jefferson disapproved of the idea, and in 1811, the charter was allowed to lapse.
After 5 years of inflation, a second national bank was implemented under James Madison, but again, a renewal of the charter was denied by Andrew Jackson.
More inflation followed, and it is now 1841, and a hard time in financial circles.
The currency was fluctuating greatly, and bank fraud was rampant throughout the country. It seemed necessary to have a national bank to stabilize the country's financial situation.
So, it's 1841. The Whigs are in control of the Congress. A national bank is the brainchild of the Whigs. John Tyler became president, and he is a Whig, so...
So, on August 16, 1841, Tyler vetoes the charter, and the demonstration begin outside the White House, instigated by the Whigs. A Federal Reserve System would not begin again until 1913.
On August 16, 1987, a plane was beginning to take off from a Detroit airport. According to information released, it was Northwest Flight 255 and was headed for California.
The pilots failed to make their pre-flight checks, and as a result, the takeoff warning system was not turned on, which led to the mistake. Neither the pilot nor co-pilot extended the wind flap, which is necessary for proper liftoff.
As a result, the plane was only 40 feet off the ground when it should have been 600 feet.
The aircraft hit a lamppost and a rental car office and crashed onto a road only half a mile away.
Of the 155 passengers on board, the only survivor was a 4-year-old, Cecilia Sihan, of Tempe, Arizona.
On August 16th of 1984, John DeLorean was cleared of drug charges in Los Angeles court. DeLorean was a prominent automaker and had been a manager at both Pontiac and Chevrolet divisions of General Motors. He was made vice president in 1972.
In 1975, he left GM to found his own car company with dreams of developing a futuristic car. Production costs skyrocketed on him, so his dream car came off the assembly line with a price tag of $25,000, at a time when most cars were selling for $10,000.
Following charges of financial irregularities, the British government announced the closing of the DeLorean Motor Car Company. On that same day, DeLorean was arrested and charged with conspiring to distribute cocaine.
It was seemingly an airtight case, with DeLorean facing a 60-year prison sentence. Surprisingly, the jury acquitted him on August 16, 1984.
You may never own a DeLorean car, but at least you can still see one. It is the car that appears in the 1985 film Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox driving.
On this day in 1948, George Herman Babe Ruth died in New York from cancer. Ruth had begun his career in Baltimore in 1914. It was during training camp in Fayetteville, North Carolina, that Babe Ruth hit his first official home run on March 7th.
That same year, he was traded to the Boston Red Sox and was now a major leaguer. For the next 5 years, he was a formidable left-handed pitcher and batter. Then in 1919, he was sold to the New York Yankees and was turned into an outfielder to make better use of his batting skills.
At a time when baseball was still suffering through the aftermath of the Black Sox scandal, Ruth brought a new respectability and interest to the game. He hit 60 home runs during the 1927 season and 714 in his career and led the Yankees to 7 pennants. Off the field, he made headlines with his charitable contributions and visits to children's hospitals.
In 1935, he retired from baseball and in 1946 was diagnosed with throat cancer. On June 13 of 1948, he made one last uniform appearance at Yankee Stadium, the ballpark that would come to be known as the house that Ruth built. He came that day to retire his playing jersey, the famous number 3. He died 2 months later.
In 1996, a bronze statue of Ruth was placed outside the Camden Yards Stadium in Baltimore. Now, contrary to some popular belief, there is not a mistake with Ruth's glove. Susan Lurie, who made the sculpture, said that after her research, she modeled the glove after the kind that would have been used in 1914, his rookie year. It was made out of soft leather that could be switched to either hand.
And now from Baltimore to Minnesota and August 17th, when in 1862 the Dakota Uprising began. Treaties had been made in July and August of 1851, whereby the Dakotas ceded much of their land to the U.S. government in exchange for goods and food. They also had to agree to live on a stretch of land about 20 miles by 150 miles on the upper Minnesota River.
Over the ensuing years, many of the promises made in the treaties were not kept. Provisions didn't arrive, either lost or stolen by unscrupulous Indian agents. Annuities were given to local traders to pay off existing claims or withheld because of the expenses of the Civil War. Then on May 1st of 1858, Minnesota was admitted into statehood and the Indian situation got even worse.
The Dakotas sent a delegation to Washington to try and get the government to enforce the provisions of the treaty, but just the opposite happened. The new wave of settlers demanded land and timber, and game was needed to feed the newcomers. What the Indians had looked good, so it was taken, which meant that they lost not only the living territory, but land for planting crops and a shortage of game for hunting.
The Indians got by until 1862, which was an especially difficult year. Disease had ruined much of their corn crop, and local traders refused to grant them any more credit. When a hunting party that went out looking for food returned empty, they tried to steal some eggs from a nearby farm. A fight ensued, and on August 17th, several farmers were killed.
The Indians felt that war was inevitable, so they attacked local agencies and settlers. When they attacked the settlement at New Ulm, 500 settlers and 150 Indians were killed. President Lincoln sent a detachment of soldiers to settle the region, and more than 2,000 Indians were rounded up. 300 warriors were condemned to death.
Although Lincoln commuted most of the sentences, 30 men were executed on December 26, 1862. It was the largest mass execution in American history.
In 1943, there was a great race taking place between the Americans and the British. It was during the Second World War, and the race involved which commander would reach Messina first. On August 17th, when Montgomery entered the city, who do you think he found waiting for him? George Patton. Patton had won the race to Messina. This occupation ended the conquest of Sicily.
Though Patton was one of the ablest generals of the Second World War, he was also one of the most controversial. There was the notorious incident when he struck a young soldier who was suffering from battle fatigue and accused him of cowardice. General Eisenhower reprimanded Patton and forced him to apologize.
In spite of his shame over this event, Patton was recognized as a tactical genius and was named to head the Third Army in the invasion of France. His participation was strategic in the final American victory.
Some have suggested that Patton was a soldier meant for war and feared that he would not fit easily into peacetime. That may be true, for he survived the war and then began having personal difficulties in leading history-collecting activities, as was required in his final European command.
To raise his spirits, he agreed to attend a pheasant hunting party and while riding in a car on December 9, 1945, was involved in an auto accident. Everyone else suffered minor injuries, but Patton suffered extreme head trauma, which left him paralyzed from the neck down. He died December 21, 1945.
Did you know that George Patton was also on the 1912 American Pentathlon Olympic team in Stockholm? He placed 20th in shooting, 7th in swimming, 4th in fencing, 6th in equestrian, and 3rd in athletics, and finished 5th overall.
August 17, 1978 became an important date in aviation history.
Well, wait a minute. I think that date should be December 17, 1903. That's when Wilbur and Orville Wright made the first flight over Kill Devil Hills in North Carolina.
Technically, that was called the first controlled, powered, and sustained heavier-than-air human flight. But this event on August 17th involved crossing the Atlantic.
But other people did that before 1978.
Right again. 1919, the U.S. Navy accomplished the feat between May 8th and May 31st. They started out with 4 planes and planned to do it in stages, using ships at sea as navigation landmarks. 1 of the 4 planes made it.
Then just 6 weeks later, British pilots Alcock and Brown made the trip nonstop between June 14th to 15th. They flew from Newfoundland to Ireland.
But I thought Charles Lindbergh was the first to fly across the Atlantic.
He was the first to do it all by himself. That was May 21st, 1927.
But there are other ways of flying.
I know. I once jumped out of the barn and flew.
How far?
All the way to the ground.
And you landed safely?
Missed the pitchfork by that much.
I meant something else.
Right! The first transatlantic flight by the rigid airship was made in July of 1919, and regular passenger crossings were being made by dirigibles beginning in 1928.
Still something else. Hot air balloon.
But balloons have been around a lot earlier than 1978.
Right again. Balloon flight was developed in the 1870s by Joseph and Etienne Mongolier. Back then, they were filled with hydrogen and helium to help with buoyancy.
And in 1875, Frenchman Jean-Pierre Blancard and American John Jeffries crossed the English Channel.
But that distance was far short of crossing the Atlantic.
Indeed. And the distance proved formidable. 14 known attempts were made before 1978, and several of them ended in a fatality. But technology made hot air flight safer and more efficient. And then it was 1978.
On August 12, Ben Abruzzo, Maxie Anderson, and Larry Newman lifted off from Preak Isle, Maine, in the airship Double Eagle.
And 137 hours later, on August 17, 1978, they set down in a field just outside of Paris. Mission accomplished. The first manned hot air balloon crossing of the Atlantic Ocean.
Did you know they had a lottery afterwards and Larry Newman won? He and his wife were allowed to sleep in the same bed that Charles Lindbergh had slept in when he completed his historic trip 5 decades before.
Did Lindbergh also leave that bed to his wife as his second best bed?
What?
Well, it was what Shakespeare had done.
Bob, maybe your landing in the hay pile wasn't as safe as you thought it was.
Meanwhile, back on August 17th, in 1877, Billy the Kid killed his first man. Billy later would claim that he had killed 21 men, one for each of the years that he had lived. But other sources put the figure as high as 90.
However, his first killing may not have been entirely his fault. He was working as a teamster at the time at an army post and had been subjected to the bullying of a burly blacksmith, Frank Cahill. One day, Cahill called young Billy a pimp. Billy responded by calling Cahill a SOB.
I know what that means. It's Australian. Shrimp on the Barbie. And that made him mad?
Very. Cahill attacked the teenager and pinned him to the ground. Billy responded by pulling his gun and killing Cahill. Fearing imprisonment, he left.
Although not completely cold-blooded, it was his first step into crime, a step that didn't end until July 14, 1881, when Sheriff Pat Garrett killed William Bonney, Billy the Kid.
On August 17, 1937, Lou Gehrig played in his 1,308th consecutive game, breaking the old mark set by Everett Scott. He would go on to play a total of 2,130 consecutive games.
That record would not be broken until September 6, 1995. It was broken by Cal Ripken of the Baltimore Orioles.
Did you know that on August 17th, when Gehrig set the record, he went 1-for-4 and drove in a run as the Yankees beat Washington 8-0?
And now to August 18th. On this date in 1992, basketball star Larry Bird retired. He had been an outstanding player in high school and had received a scholarship to play for Bobby Knight at the University of Indiana. However, he was homesick and returned to his hometown of French Lick, Indiana, population under 2,000, and eventually played for Indiana State. As a sophomore, he led his team to an undefeated season until they met Michigan State.
Did you know that that game was one of the most highly viewed at that time? And did you know that the Michigan State team was led by Magic Johnson?
Bird entered the NBA in 1979 and joined the Boston Celtics and was the Rookie of the Year, leading the Celtics to a record of 61 wins and 21 losses.
And did you know that the Celtics were 29-53 the previous year and had finished in last place?
In his next year, playing with Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish, they won an NBA championship. They won again in 1984 and 1986.
A further triumph for Bird came in 1992 when he played on the U.S. Olympic team, the first year that professionals were allowed to play. Some of his teammates were Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, and Charles Barkley. They won the gold.
When he retired in 1992, NBA Commissioner David Stern released a statement wherein he said, "In the future, great players will be judged against the standards that he has set. But there will never be another Larry Bird."
Did you know that Larry Bird could go up into the stands and throw a basketball that rebounded off the scoreboard, then off the floor, and then through the hoop with nothing but net?
Bob, he did that in a commercial with Michael Jordan.
Yeah, but he won Michael Jordan's hamburger by doing it.
In 1795... George Washington signed the Jay Treaty with Great Britain. The Revolutionary War may have ended, but tensions were still high between the new nation and England. There was a problem of British forts all along our northern and western borders. And with a war still going on between England and France, American ships had been seized by the British in the West Indies.
Chief Justice John Jay was sent to England to negotiate a treaty to deal with these and other issues. When he returned, the treaty he had negotiated was met with opposition from both Jefferson and Madison. It was feared that the treaty made too many concessions to England in addition to paying pre-revolutionary debts to British merchants.
Washington lobbied hard for the treaty, feeling that the concessions were something the new country could manage. Another war with Britain, they could not. Washington also had to deal with one underlying feeling that a strong alliance with France was desirable, even if it meant war with England.
On August 14th, Congress affirmed the treaty with a bare two-third majorities needed. And on August 18th, 1795, Washington signed it. Unfortunately, the peace didn't last, and 17 years later was the War of 1812.
Much more recently, on August 18, 1991, Soviet hardliners launched a coup to overthrow Premier Mikhail Gorbachev. Since he took over that position in 1988, Gorbachev had been involved with the restructuring of the Russian state. The names in the news were Perestroika, a movement towards a more free market economy, and Glasnost, a new openness in diplomacy.
Gorbachev faced opposition on two fronts, hardliners and the military on one side, who feared that Russia would lose its position of world power, and radical reformers on the other side, led by Boris Yeltsin. They felt that Gorbachev wasn't moving fast enough with his reforms.
So on August 18th, a coup was started. Gorbachev was placed under house arrest at his villa in the Crimea. He was pressured to resign, but he refused.
It was at this point that Yeltsin stepped in. He called on the people to strike to protest the coup. Soldiers tried to arrest him, but found their way blocked by citizens, armed and unarmed. Yeltsin climbed on top of a tank and condemned the coup as a new reign of terror. The soldiers backed off, and some even changed sides. The coup failed in 3 days, and Gorbachev was flown back to Moscow.
The coup may have failed, and Gorbachev did go on to grant independence to the Balkan states and proposed a looser, more economically based federation. But the regime had been dealt a serious blow. In December of 1991, Gorbachev resigned as premier.
And did you know who took his place? Boris Yeltsin.
And on August 18th, 1227, Genghis Khan died. He was born Temujin around 1162, and rose to become the founder and great Khan of the Mongol Empire.
By 1227, Genghis Khan had captured much of Central Asia and began moves against Eastern Europe, Persian, and India.
Did you know that the cause of his death may have been a fall from a horse the previous year?
And on to August 19th. In 1812, the USS Constitution earned its nickname, Old Ironsides. It was one of six frigates commissioned to be built, and it was constructed at the shipworks in Boston.
Did you know that the bolts made to fasten the timbers together were furnished by Benjamin Franklin?
When launched on October 21, 1797, the ship was 204 feet long, displacing 2,200 tons, and was rated as a 44-gun frigate, though she often carried 50 guns.
In 1798, she was sent to the West Indies to protect U.S. shipping from French pirates. Then in 1803, Thomas Jefferson sent the ship to the Mediterranean to combat the Barbary pirates. She performed admirably, and when a peace treaty was signed with Tripoli, it was done on the decks of the USS Constitution.
Then in 1812, when war broke out with England, the USS Constitution returned to Boston. On August 19th, the USS Constitution encountered the British warship Guerriere. For 20 minutes, the ships bombarded each other with drastically different results. The Guerriere was demasted and rendered a wreck. The Constitution suffered only minor damage.
Witnesses claim that the cannonballs from the Guerriere seemed to bounce off the side of the Constitution as it was made of iron, and so was born its nickname, Old Ironsides. Old Ironsides went on to capture or destroy seven more English ships during the War of 1812.
That ship can still be seen in Boston. It's part of the Freedom Trail tour.
In 1931, China was stricken with one of the worst floods in history. From 1928 to 1930, China had suffered through extreme drought conditions and had finally begun to change during the winter of 1930. And when rains started coming, it was torrential, and added to the rains were cyclones. Normally, the area received two cyclones a year. In 1931, seven hit during the month of July alone.
Most of the rainfall also hit during the months of July and August. The main rivers affected were the Yellow, the Yangtze, and the Huai. During July, rain stations along the Yangtze River reported receiving 24 inches of rain in that month. And the high water mark was noted at Hankou, where water reached a height that was 53 feet above normal. The level of 53 feet was reached on August 19, 1931.
A week after the flood mark at Hankou, disaster struck the Grand Canal. At 1,104 miles in length, it is the longest artificial river in the world, connecting the Yellow and the Yangtze rivers. Water rushing through the canal washed away the dikes at Gaoyu Lake, and an estimated 200,000 people were drowned while sleeping. In all, estimates are as high as 3.7 million people lost their lives during the 1931 floods.
On August 19th of 1909, Louis Switzer won the first auto race to be held at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The idea of the speedway was from Carl Fisher, a local businessman, and some of his associates, who envisioned a better way of testing cars from assembly plants before they were delivered to consumers.
Though affectionately called the Brickyard, no race was held on bricks until December. The original surface was packed soil covered with gravel, limestone, and tar. This surface proved to be unsafe, and several fatalities occurred on the first weekend of racing. AAA boycotted the event until improvements were made.
But some racing did take place. On August 14th, motorcycles raced, and on August 19th, autos made their appearance.
Before the main event of 250 miles, a preliminary was held that lasted two laps and covered 5 miles. So technically, the first winner of an auto race at Indianapolis was Louis Switzer.
Switzer was driving a stripped-down Stoddard Dayton, which achieved an average speed of 57.4 miles per hour over the 5-mile race. Did you know that between 15 and 20,000 people showed up that first day to watch the racing?
And did you know that another kind of racing took place before the motorcycles and cars showed up? On June 5th of 1909, helium-filled gas balloons raced. 40,000 people showed up for that.
And did you know that the first 500 miles race held at the Brickyard occurred on Memorial Day, May 30th, 1911?
And did you know that the race was won by Ray Hurren with an average speed of 74.602 miles per hour?
And did you know that the engine that powered that car was the famous Marmon Yellow Jacket, designed by Louis Switzer?
On August 19, 1951, Eddie Guidel made his major league debut with the old St. Louis Browns.
What's so strange about that? Lots of people played Major League Baseball.
Right. What was so strange about this player was that the whole thing was a publicity stunt thought up by club owner Bill Veeck. Guidel came to the plate wearing the number 1/8.
Guidel wasn't a regular ball player. He was a stuntman standing only 3 feet 7 inches. He walked on 4 straight pitches and then was replaced by a pinch runner.
Did you know that in the crouch that Veeck instructed him to use, he had a strike zone of only 1.5 inches?
And did you know that Guidel holds the Major League record for being the shortest man ever to play Major League Baseball?
And did you know that he also holds the record for the highest lifetime on-base percentage? 1,000. One plate appearance, one walk.
On August 19th of 1895, John Wesley Hardin was killed in Texas. Hardin was one of the deadliest killers of the Old West. He shot his first man when he was 15. During the next 10 years, he killed somewhere between 20 and 40 men. One for no other reason than because he snored.
In 1878, he was convicted of killing a Texas sheriff and spent 14 years in prison. He seemed to have calmed down during that time and even studied law. When released in 1892, he worked as a lawyer and even ran, unsuccessfully, for public office.
In 1895, the sheriff of El Paso tried to make the town a little less lawless by making it illegal to carry a gun within the city limits.
Well, that seemed like a good idea.
Well, on August 19th of 1895, Hardin's girlfriend was caught within the city carrying a gun and was arrested by Officer John Selman.
Hardin flew into a rage and threatened to kill Selman. Later that day, Selman walked into a bar where Hardin was throwing dice. He stepped behind him and shot him in the head.
On August 19, 1862, Horace Greeley published The Prayer of 20 Millions. Greeley was the publisher of the New York Tribune, and his editorial of that day called upon Lincoln to end slavery. He voiced the impatience of many Northern abolitionists that Lincoln wasn't acting quickly enough to end this terrible practice.
Greeley had started the paper as a paper dedicated to reform. He advocated temperance, westward expansion, the labor movement, and he was against capital punishment, land monopoly, and at the head of the list, slavery.
And now for some celebrity birthdays for this week. On August 14th in 1851, Doc Holliday, and in 1950, Far Side cartoonist Gary Larson.
On August 15th in 1771, author Sir Walter Scott, in 1879, actress Ethel Barrymore, and in 1912, Chef Julia Child.
On August 16th, in 1862, football pioneer Amos Alonzo Stagg. In 1888, writer T.E. Lawrence. And in 1932, Charles Lindbergh, and also singer Edie Gourmet.
On August 17th, in 1786, Davy Crockett. In 1893, actress Mae West. And in 1921, actress Maureen O'Hara.
On August 18th in 1774, explorer Meriwether Lewis. In 1904, Max Factor of the cosmetics firm. And in 1936, actor Robert Redford.
And on August 19th in 1871, Orville Wright. And in 1921, Gene Roddenberry, creator of Star Trek.
This is Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and thank you for listening in to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Par Tolleson. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is available as a podcast following its initial broadcast.
We'd especially like to thank WRAL.com, a part of the Raleigh-based Capital New Media Group, for their support in helping keeping programs like Did You Know on the air.
If any of you could assist in underwriting our programming, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.
And this is Bob Martin. And I haven't found anything yet that happened in August that compares to August 10th.
You mean that day where nothing of importance happened?
King George just hasn't heard yet.
Well, until he does, we'll continue on next week with some events from the past that happened in August.
Until then...
Goodbye.